Well, it is an honor for me to welcome you here tonight. And we are very pleased and proud to have this as the first event and the inaugural occasion for the Center for the Study of the Southern Baptist Convention. I want to welcome you to Southern Seminary's campus, and I want to welcome you to this discussion. I very much look forward to hearing what will be said and to taking part as much as is possible in the conversation. This is a matter very near to us, and we need to admit from the onset that we come with varying degrees of intimacy and distance from some of the issues here to be discussed. And yet, the one thing upon which we are all agreed is that there is something significant about the study of the Southern Baptist Convention, in particular, this time, recognizing the transitions that are now and have been taking place, we understand that this is of significance beyond the Southern Baptist Convention. The mission and purpose of the Center for the Study of the Southern Baptist Convention is very clear and straightforward. It is to be a center for research on the reality of the Southern Baptist Convention and that reality writ large. It will deal with history, but beyond that, sociology, demographics, theology, all issues germane as we seek to get a handle on America's largest non-Catholic denomination, as sometimes it is described, America's largest evangelical denomination, as many of us hope, but in any event, a denomination that is woefully under-researched, understudied, and therefore poorly understood both without and within. When you look at Roman Catholicism in America or North America alone, there are numerous study centers, well-endowed, well-funded, both producing research and funding research and then building a body of collected data upon which further reflection is accomplished. But among Southern Baptists, there is nothing of a coordinated center. And given the events of the Southern Baptist Convention over the recent decades, and especially given the institutional divisions that have taken place in Baptist life, it is unlikely that there will be any one center alone where such things take place. But even if this is one among several or one among many, the need is for this conversation to be begun and then hopefully for it to be shared and extended. No matter where one stands vis-a-vis the Southern Baptist controversy, we ought to admit the need for very serious research and reflection and analysis. I'm proud that Dr. Greg Wills is serving as director of this center. He is superbly equipped for this task, academically, personally, administratively, and most pleasing is the sense of purpose that is behind his leadership in this center. This is an inaugural event to be followed, we hope, by an ongoing and progressively well-funded effort to understand where we are and where Southern Baptists are going. We want the center to foster communication, to gather materials, and to sponsor and publish research. My intention tonight is not to bring an academic paper in this opening session, but rather to speak directly to the issue. The title of my address is Southern Baptists in the New Millennium, The Quest for Identity in an Age of Uncertainty. And at the onset, I need to admit that there is some awkwardness in this, as speaking to a group, many of whom, that is of its members, are professional historians. I do not come to speak tonight as a professional historian. I do want to deal with matters historical. I would not claim to be objective. I want to admit at the onset the participant-observer problem. Whenever we speak to this, and in particular one who has had an active part, I would not claim to be objective, but I do aspire to be reflective. And I look forward to a conversation I hope will begin tonight. I also recognize the warning that Adolf von Harnack gave his own students. He who would be a church historian must of necessity be also a church politician. There is no part of church history that is not political, and there's no part of church politics that is not historical. We speak to these issues tonight in the complicating context of controversy. And these days, to discuss Baptist identity, the Southern Baptist Convention, its future, its past, or its present, is to bring on a context of controversy. I want to make some arguments concerning how we ought to understand the Southern Baptist controversy, and how we should particularly contextualize the events of the last two decades of the 20th century. The conservative historian John Lukacs and the Marxist historian Eric Hobsbawm have both argued in recent histories of the 20th century that the two pivotal events of the century were the two great world wars. But both argue, interestingly enough, that it is a mistake to speak of two world wars. Rather, upon reflection, it is more accurate to speak of one great world cataclysm interrupted by an artificial peace. Like one of the problems in speaking of the Southern Baptist controversy is that we try to date that controversy beginning in 1979 with the election of Adrian Rogers as president of the Southern Baptist Convention, or perhaps we move back to the Broadman commentary controversy and the election of W.A. Criswell as president in 1969, an event that brought on the E.Y. Mullins Fellowship and an organized response. Perhaps some would push it back beyond that to 1963, when the Baptist Faith and Message Statement was revised, and to the Eliot controversy that precipitated that process and event. I want to push back the origins of the Southern Baptist controversy to the 1920s and the fundamentalist modernist controversy that was more remarkably fought out and immediately debated in the mainline Protestant denominations. I would argue that Southern Baptists have experienced one great running controversy from the 1920s to the present. Unlike the Presbyterians and other mainline denominations who got over the controversy in the first half of the century, largely by schism and moderate or modernist victories in the mainline churches, among Southern Baptists, the fundamentalist modernist controversy was sublimated after original sparks and bangs, and Southern Baptist institutionalist denominational statesmen came up with what appeared to be a surefire and certain method of avoiding the kind of division and polarization that took place in the mainline Protestant denominations. They established a committee. The committee was to bring a report. The committee brought a report that was intended to produce a consensus statement. The consensus statement operated for some time as both a release valve and a safety check for the denomination in terms of avoiding polarization, or as I would argue, sublimating that polarization. I want to argue that to understand Southern Baptists in the present is to understand the controversy of the last 20 years, which is to go back further to the roots of that controversy in the early decades of the 20th century, and thus we would understand, I would contend, the Southern Baptist controversy of the last 20 years and the Southern Baptist quandaries of the present as a delayed response to modernity. It's interesting to go back to the origins of the Southern Baptist Convention in 1845 and recognize the intactness socially and culturally of the culture that produced the Southern Baptist Convention. I'm indebted to historians of the South, particularly of the antebellum South, who demonstrate again and again the fact that there was an intact culture, not that it did not have its eccentrics and its nonconformists, but by and large, there was a discernible culture that separated the North from the South, and in particular nurtured the kind of embryonic denominationalism that produced the Southern Baptist Convention in Augusta in 1845. I would argue that the experiences of the Civil War and of Reconstruction greatly shaped the Southern Baptist mind and consciousness, but did not greatly affect Southern Baptist theology. I wish I could develop this further, but going back to, for instance, the toy controversy, there was actually very little controversy about the toy controversy. There were some isolated editorials written to protest his dismissal. But other than that, there was a general consensus that the seminary had acted in the only way that was proper and fitting, that it was a tragedy. Very few persons at that time were willing to champion Toy as some kind of hero for Baptist libertarianism. And instead, there was the recognition that whether articulated or not, or understood as confessionalism or not, there were clear boundaries and that Toy had exceeded those boundaries. It is interesting then to move to the Whitsitt controversy and to realize how little theology played a part in that controversy at all. I would argue that the closer one looks at the Whitsitt controversy, the more one is necessarily convinced that it had even less to do with Baptist history than with a confidence crisis between a president and a board of trustees. The public plausibility of presidential leadership was a more important issue there than Baptist history. The best evidence for that is the election of E.Y. Mullins as the fourth president of the institution, when Mullins was already understood also to hold to what was then called a modern view of Baptist history. But that intactness lasted for only a couple of decades into the 20th century. I would argue, had I the time, that a part of this was intentional, that is the change, and a part was unintentional. The intentional aspect came from the impetus of Southern Baptist leaders who were chastened by the humiliation of the war and by the indignities of the Reconstruction period, and who wanted to bring Southern Baptists into the 20th century as a truly modern denomination. I believe E.Y. Mullins is an exemplar of this impulse. His experience in Texas and in Mississippi, his experience coming as a child basically of an impoverished culture, and the aspirations that were his that drew him first to the North as a place of ministry, and then the models of ministry he encountered both in Baltimore and especially in Newton Center, Massachusetts, influenced him such that when he was elected president of Southern Seminary in 1899, his ambition was that this institution would lead, in large part, this denomination into the 20th century in a way that would bring Southern Baptists into a future that was then represented by the Northern denominations and their very well-funded and much-esteemed institutions. The fundamentalist-modernist controversy was not a shot in the dark, and it did not emerge in a vacuum. Anyone with theological perception could have seen these issues coming. It was a matter of where the charge would be detonated and what the fallout would be, both locally and nationally. But as it happened, the fundamentalist-modernist controversy emerged largely as a northern phenomenon. And as a northern phenomenon, Southerners watched it with interest, perhaps a bit of macabre interest. Nonetheless, it was an interest that was largely remote. I think especially when you look at the primary data, the letters, and you look at the discourse of the Southern Baptist Convention, even leading up to the 1925 Baptist Faith and Message, there was a sense that many of these issues were simply not our issues. There were individuals who they were seen as eccentrics. They were understood as progressives. I mean, after all, when you look at President Poteet and others who represented a liberal progressivist strain in the convention or on the margins of the convention at that time, I think what is most remarkable is that they were understood to be on the margins of the convention, certainly in terms of its theological consensus. In Southern Baptist life, the fundamentalist-modernist controversy emerged with some of the same issues, especially with the anti-supernaturalism, as Mullins identified the problem, in the evolution controversy. There were issues related to the interpretation and the status and the authority of Scripture. But the more I look to the events, the writings, and the records of that era, the more I am convinced that the leadership of the denomination sought in every way to avoid focusing attention on those issues of Scripture and authority and interpretation. Virtually every, and you go back and look at, for instance, drafts of the 25 committee and the kinds of documents they were working with, almost every effort was made to speak with the first person plural, we. We hold, we agree, we affirm, we confirm. And there was an assumption that a consensus statement was achievable and that it would be workable as a way of getting Southern Baptists through the fundamentalist-modernist controversy unscathed. I describe this as a delayed crisis of modernity because it could only be delayed, it could not be deferred indefinitely, and it could not be avoided eventually. I would argue that the period of the Second World War and of the Eisenhower years that followed brought about a sort of peace, a truce on these issues, but it was not a time of immobility. To the contrary, progressives were moving now much more freely in a progressivist direction. They had a platform, a vehicle for moving in that direction in a way that was not so apparent and blatant as had been the modernists of the 1920s, neo-orthodoxy in its various forms, and I do speak of neo-orthodoxies as a plural variety of systems, nonetheless, as a generalized effort at a mediating position in theological method and substance. We saw Southern Baptist academics moving progressively to the left, but in ways that were not immediately understood as threatening. The apparent unity of the Southern Baptist Convention in that era raises an interesting question that I hope some historians will pick up. It is this question: do we, in looking at Southern Baptists in the 20th century, see primarily an apparent unity interrupted by controversy, or do we see an ongoing controversy interrupted by periods of stability and programmatic unity? I will argue that the convention's controversies that began in the 1920s were sublimated for some years, but by the 1960s, the controversy was undeniable. By the 1970s, the conflict was inevitable. By the 1980s, the collision was fully operational. By the 1990s, the division was organizational. And now, facing a new millennium, the analysis is combustible. There are historical, theological, and institutional issues at stake. As we are all aware, there are financial matters of concern, and all of these issues are deeply emotional. And this is to be admitted at the onset. We have, in the year 2001, the benefit of at least some perspective of distance. But for many of us, it is a very near distance. Just as an autobiographical note, I came to Southern Seminary in 1980 as an MDiv student. I came from Samford University. Adrian Rogers had been elected in the summer of 1979. I knew his name. But in my college experience, there was very little mention of any controversy in the Southern Baptist Convention. It was basically off the radar screen. If the Southern Baptist Convention was intact, it was, I would say, most intact in Alabama. And in Alabama, if it was intact, it was greatly intact on the campus of Samford University. There was very little discussion. There had been some isolated incidents, perhaps a notorious professor here and there, but there was no sense that the generalized stability of the Southern Baptist Convention and of the inherited culture was in any way threatened. But when I arrived at Southern Seminary in the fall of 1990, a very different perspective immediately befell me, because this institution was at that time gearing up for high hysteria in terms of the Southern Baptist controversy. If it appeared to be almost nothing on the radar screen in Alabama, by the time I came to Southern in 1980, it was as if the battle cry had been sounded. But I think it's fair to say that most persons in institutional life in the Southern Baptist Convention thought that this would be a repeat of the 1920s or perhaps of the 1960s. There would be a few isolated years of controversy, and then there would be a return to normality. The turning point, I will argue, in the controversy came in 1990. I think it's fair to say, by the political mobilization, by the propaganda, by the rhetoric, that moderates did not concede a total and cataclysmic loss politically in the SBC until the year 1990 with the election of Morris Chapman over Daniel Vestal in the New Orleans Convention. The period from 1980 to 1990 is so significant in understanding the Southern Baptist controversy, and yet it seems so long ago already. It is hard for most persons who did not live through that era to imagine there once was a time when it did not appear that the conservatives would win. There certainly was no inevitability to conservative victory in the SBC. And again, I think there are many persons today, especially a younger generation of pastors and seminary students, who simply do not understand that. And thus they cannot understand the dynamic of the 80s. They can't understand the language, the propaganda, the political machinations, or all the rest. But after that turning point in 1990 came another decade of developments, and these would have been inconceivable in any other Southern Baptist age. The emergence of what became known as the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, the polity issues that emerged between the SBC and the state conventions. These had been, and I can say this now as a president of a Southern Baptist agency and participating in those discussions now for a number of years, and then having been a state paper editor, I think it's safe to say that virtually no one in Southern Baptist life during the 1980s, and certainly even more so in previous generations, would even have dared articulate or prognosticate about the possibility of the kinds of developments that came in the 1990s. It was officially off limits to even conceive of such things, much less to speak of them. outside some private conversation. Looking back from the perspective of 2001 to the years from 1990 to the present, we can see that the controversy produced more than either side had anticipated. And the eventual result was something that neither party in the SBC, I think, fully expected. There are some points of analysis for which I would contend. The first of these is that the two parties in the Southern Baptist Convention were further apart than was first apparent. The distance separating, I guess this is actually the second point I wish to make after the fact that we have one controversy from the 1920s to the present. The second would be that the two parties in the SBC were always separated by a greater distance than first appeared. And here I think the relative intactness of a Southern Baptist denominational culture was a cover, perhaps intentionally and perhaps just institutionally. It was a cover that camouflaged the distance that had emerged. Looking back, it is easier to see now than it was at the time. There were theological differences that are now apparent that were not apparent then. We hear the voices of some of the protagonists and the participants in the controversy now, and when we go back to look at their words years ago, they have a different meaning invested than first appeared, perhaps revealed than first appeared. There were theological differences, but even though those became the main focus of the controversy, that was never all there was. That's a simplistic reductionism to say that the controversy was only over theology. Now, as I will argue in just a few moments, one of the great misunderstandings, I believe, of the moderates was the delayed understanding that it was theological at core for the conservatives. But the conservatives need to admit that there was always more than theology at stake. Politics were an issue, both denominational politics and political engagement in the larger national arena. Cultural engagement was very much a part of the controversy. Two different understandings, at least two different understandings of culture and of a proper mode of Christian cultural engagement, evangelical cultural engagement, and in particular, Baptist cultural engagement. I would argue that the two parties in the SBC, in terms of at least a majority in both of those parties, had identified with different sectors of the larger culture. And their cultural symbols were different. Their cultural heroes were different. Their mode of engagement with the culture, all these were very distinct and different. Southern Baptist moderates and conservatives were separated by ecclesiology and especially by practices. Now, for instance, here again, there was something that was sublimated, and I can speak specifically of Georgia and in particular of Atlanta, which is of no little interest to Baptist polity at present, given the controversies in the Atlanta Baptist Association. But that association is by no means a newcomer to controversy. One of the large controversies in that association during the early years of the Southern Baptist controversy was over alien immersion. And that was a wake-up call for many conservatives in Georgia when they understood that it wasn't just one notorious church that was allowing explicitly and publicly alien immersion and non-Baptist forms of baptism, but actually it was a more widespread practice than they imagined. And it wasn't just then the issue of baptism, it was the pattern they detected of acquiescence among some and outrage among others. There were moral and ethical issues that separated Southern Baptist moderates and conservatives when neither of them really understood it. The issue of abortion, I will argue, was more significant in the Southern Baptist controversy than has generally been understood. And I think for both sides, it functioned in very different ways. Most Baptist conservatives, I think it's fair to say, assumed that virtually all Southern Baptists were opposed to abortion. I can say from personal experience that I know many SBC conservatives who simply had not considered that there would be major Baptist pastors who would be supportive of abortion rights and would champion and celebrate the passage of Roe v. Wade. And this gives some indication of how little attention conservatives paid to the convention process in years up to the Southern Baptist controversy. One of the questions one has to raise is how in the world did basically pro-abortion resolutions get adopted by the Southern Baptist Convention? And why did those resolutions largely escape conservative notice? Well, because conservatives weren't voting on those resolutions. They weren't greatly concerned with the resolutions process, and they didn't give much attention to the resolutions once they were adopted. Until some boiling point was reached, some critical mass was achieved when this became a rallying point. I'll just say this as a footnote. I think for many grassroots Southern Baptists, the issue of inerrancy was rather difficult to understand, but the issue of abortion, for instance, was very easy to understand. And as conservatives sought to point to the problem in the SBC that demanded immediate action, the issue of abortion was very important. And thus, even though, of course, that is deeply rooted in a theological worldview, it is a moral and ethical issue that was the presenting cause there. The larger issue is now, and always has been, Baptist identity. And this is an argument over history. At least it begins, perhaps, with history. First of all, there is a debate over what our history actually is. And by the way, that assumes we have a history, a singular history. But for many persons, there is a debate to be joined over the nature and the character of Baptist history. For others, they're not even participants in the debate. But for those who consider such a question important, there is a secondary question, and that is, how binding should such a history be? And here, moderates and conservatives have different understandings of the history and different understandings of its binding authority upon the Baptist present, or certainly which aspects of Baptist history are to be given preferential treatment over others and greater authority. It has been over history. It has also been a conflict over core beliefs. In the early years of the controversy, the standard moderate argument was that we are not separated by theology, but by two different understandings of the denomination. This is a political rather than a theological struggle. I have to say, I think one of the turning points was when at least some moderates began to make the case themselves that this is deeply theological. And an individual to whom I would point there is Cecil Sherman, who became the first coordinator of the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship. He was one of the first I heard to state explicitly that there were deep theological differences separating the moderates from the conservatives and expressing frustration that the moderates were not dealing with theological issues. Now, to give Dr. Sherman his due, and I have found him always to be a deeply honest man, not to mention candid, he is quite certain that our theology, that is, a Southern Baptist conservatives, is not merely wrong but dangerous. And again, he has not been reluctant to make his convictions clear, and I at least appreciate his honesty. But now it is a commonplace to understand that there are theological differences separating us, and then by extension of the argument, there always were, at least during the controversy, core beliefs that were at stake. The third aspect of Baptist identity that has always been at stake is the basic vision for the denomination. My first editorial as editor of the Christian Index was a thank you for bringing me to Georgia editorial. It basically doesn't count for anything. You have to introduce yourself, it's just good form. But the first editorial I wrote after becoming editor, and I assumed that post during the Las Vegas Southern Baptist Convention in 1989, I was faced with the awful realization that I had only one of two options. I would either say something or not. And I had been elected to say something. I thought that's what the board expected me to do and what readers expected. I soon found out that that was an erroneous assumption. But nonetheless, it was a starting point. And I argued that what separated Southern Baptists was a basic conflict of visions. I was frustrated that others did not see this. I borrowed the category from the economist at Stanford University, the Hoover Institution, Thomas Sowell, in his book of the same title, The Conflict of Visions, in which, in the political dynamic, he tries to explain why persons consistently line up against each other in political argument without any apparent linkage between the issues. And I would rather speak of worldview and the clash of worldview perspectives, but to use his category of visions, Sowell says that every institution, every polis, every city, every organization is established in a basic vision or worldview, and that conflict comes when that worldview is no longer shared, that vision becomes a matter of debate and division. His concern was the political context of the American Republic. My concern was the denominational family known as Southern Baptists, but his argument, I thought, was extremely perceptive and applicable here. Because what separated conservatives from moderates, or however you want to label them, in the SBC was nothing that was simple. It was abortion, but it wasn't just abortion. And it's not to say that everyone on the moderate side supported abortion. It's just that that was an issue that played a part. Inerrancy was an important part. But behind all of this was a constellation of symbols and of doctrines and of beliefs in which in the end, and I'm going to say that again, in the end, not in the entire process, but in the end, by the time you come to 1990, for instance, Southern Baptists had to make a choice about which party they intended to invest with leadership in the Southern Baptist Convention. I use the word party. Here I return to two articles I wrote that were published during the controversy in which I argued that Southern Baptists are truly separated into two different parties, and this goes back, I'm including here among Southern Baptists a larger family, some of whom no longer identify as Southern Baptists, but who were very much a part of the controversy in the 80s and the 90s. The one party I identify first is a truth party, and the second is a liberty party. And without going into great detail there, I refer you to the article I wrote on Baptist Evangelicals and Evangelical Baptists in the Southern Baptist and American Evangelicalism volume, and also the Beyond the Impasse volume that is itself now one of the interesting artifacts of the Southern Baptist controversy. I go back and read it, and it seems like someone much younger and hardly known to me was a part of a debate that took place back then, and it's interesting to go back and look at it. I still want to make the same arguments. I go back and I associate myself very much with the same arguments. That's an argument I still want to make, enumerated in those various points. But what's clear to me now is that we were past that by the time that actual debate took place in history. All that was water under the bridge, so to speak. And by that time, we were already doing autopsy rather than diagnosis. But the Truth Party and the Liberty Party are divided by this basic vision, a vision of what the denomination is, what its history represents, what its opportunities are, how its polity is to be organized, what its ethos is to be, what kind of symbols it should champion and prize. The distance between the two parties is more dramatic now, but the seeds of the present reality were sown in the 1920s, I will argue, in that controversy over supernaturalism. They were scattered during the war years, watered during the 1960s and the 70s, and they matured during the last two decades of the 20th century. By the end of the controversy's active phase, the two parties could not agree on the most basic and fundamental questions, even on the cause of the controversy in the first place. Second, the moderates and conservatives were equally surprised by the political outcome of the controversy. Neither party expected the conservatives to win. I can assure you that when I came as a student at Southern Seminary, this institution did not expect the conservatives to win. This was seen as a peasant rebellion of some sorts that would be put down like other similar rebellions. And that's not to say there was necessarily antipathy in that. It's just, I would argue that there was a rather elitist posture that saw this as a populist revolt among persons who just do not understand the issues and did not understand the Southern Baptist Convention. On the conservative side, the assumption was it isn't that we don't understand the Southern Baptist Convention, it's that we are scared to death about what we perceive to be its direction. But the conservatives didn't expect to win either. Repeatedly, you will hear reflections from Southern Baptist conservative leaders of the generation that led in the 1970s and were elected in the 1980s, reflect on the fact they did not expect to win. They thought it was a noble effort that ought to be attempted so that they could, with good conscience, remove themselves into an independent mode, but they did not expect to win. And I have to say, the fact that both sides were agreed on that assumption had some evidence behind their intuition. First, the moderates had the experience of overcoming this kind of concern before and repeatedly. In the 1920s, again, the Mullins effort. And that's not an uncomplicated question. I've entered that debate, but that's not an uncomplicated question as to what Mullen's intention was and what was the effect of his leadership. But I think at a bare minimum, we can say that the 1925 Baptist faith and message and the attendant denominational consensus that came with it survived a number of years. In fact, arguably 3 or 4 decades, but not indefinitely. The moderates, I'm sure, and I was here at the time, thought that this was a serious threat, but not one that was likely eventually to be fatal to moderate leadership in the Southern Baptist Convention. And as I say, the conservatives shared the same thing because, as Bill Leonard has argued in his book, God's Last and Only Hope, conservatives were frustrated by public victories followed by private losses. I mean, after all, what they thought they had achieved with the McDaniel Resolution in the 1920s came to nothing. And the Baptist Faith and Message revision of 1963 was, in the view of the conservatives, a step backward, not a step forward. And then the failure of any progress from their perspective in electing W.A. Criswell as a clearly conservative president of the Southern Baptist Convention in 1969, and the failure of any satisfactory resolution of the Broadman Bible Commentary taught the conservatives that this probably wasn't going to work. But it did. That led to the situation described publicly by Adrian Rogers, the first conservative to be elected president of the Southern Baptist Convention. He was elected, of course, in 1979 and again in 1986. The landscape had changed remarkably from 1979 to 1986. What was different, most importantly, in 1986 was the plausibility that conservatives just might see this through. I've had many persons say to me who were in those conversations at the time that electing a second conservative president was seen as the big trial, and especially after 1 year of Adrian Rogers' presidency. But when that happened, and then a third, and then a fourth, the election of Charles Stanley in 1984 in Kansas City was a paradigmatic event, I think, for both moderates and conservatives in the SBC, by the way. But when Adrian Rogers was renominated in 1986, the question was now, if we win, what do we do? He articulated it in the Folksy Parable. He said, we are in a situation akin to a bunch of dogs chasing a garbage truck. When the dog actually catches it, it's hard to know which is more surprised, the truck or the dog. And then the dog has to decide what it's going to do with the garbage truck. Again, I think that speaks to the effort on the part of the conservatives that they did not expect to be successful. In closing, I want to speak about the nature of the Baptist crisis in the present. I have spoken about the controversy, and I have intentionally gone back to what I see as the deeper roots in a summary fashion to place this in a context as a delayed response to modernity, but modernity will not be denied its due, and modernity has been followed by postmodernity, however we would wish to define that. We find ourselves now faced by very different realities, but continuing patterns. First, a crisis of theology and doctrine. As I said, I think it was an achievement of honesty when both parties admitted that there was an essentially theological dimension to this controversy. As another footnote, I would argue that had the moderates made this admission far earlier, and had they made any proposal for resolution, some even minimal institutional accommodation, the controversy would have been aborted. It would have ended at that point. When the conservatives were talking about parity, the moderates missed an opportunity in retrospect to have more or less negotiated some kind of peace. And the conservatives would have been, in a Southern Baptist cultural context, the conservatives would have been in a very difficult position to try to argue against almost any proposal that had come from the moderate side that appeared to be genuinely responsive to their concerns. But the admission of a theological dimension to the controversy came very late. The Truth Party and the Liberty Party argued essentially for two different visions of Baptist identity and two different understandings of the controversy. The Truth Party, to speak mostly of the conservatives, spoke very clearly that what was threatened was truth, and that truth, the faith once for all delivered to the saints, and those truths non-negotiable and essential. The Liberty Party argued that what was most threatened was Baptist liberty, And the Baptist vision behind this position basically identified issues such as the autonomy of local churches, the priesthood of the believer, as was most often formulated by moderates, and other libertarian issues as most important and fundamental. The conservatives and the moderates disagreed over priority. Is truth established by a consensus in a context of liberty, or is liberty, true Christian liberty, the fruit of a common consent to vital and essential truths? The presenting issues were scripture and higher criticism, and again, it's very interesting to go back, and there's some good historical work to be done, to go back looking at doctoral dissertations, looking at books that have escaped any kind of public notice, articles written by Southern Baptist Seminary professors, and I would say also by pastors, the kind of sermons preached by pastors that would indicate that historical critical methods of biblical interpretation had made inroads far beyond anything most persons would recognize during the 40s and the 50s, as well as the 60s and thereafter. There were arguments over the interpretation of the Bible. The moderates generally argued that it was all interpretation and nothing to do with the authority of Scripture. The conservatives argued that it was just the authority of Scripture and very little to do with interpretation, and both were wrong in some measure. There was a deeper reality. The moderates had championed a fundamental reordering of Baptist doctrine. I didn't say necessarily even a revision, but at least a reordering among most moderates as to issues of priority. The conservatives in the beginning were uncertain how pervasive the problem is. Just look at the kind of language that was used as Southern Baptist conservatives running for president of the SBC said the problem in the SBC isn't liberalism, it's neo-orthodoxy. Meanwhile, most Southern Baptist academics have moved far beyond neo-orthodoxy. Conservatives were very uncertain as to how they would get a handle on such a thing, but by the time we get to the 1990s, and most clearly in, I would say, the last 5 or 6 years, looking at public statements and at writings by persons who were very active in the Southern Baptist controversy in the 70s and the 80s, we now see that there was a cleavage, a deep divide on issues as basic as the doctrine of God, the nature of creation, the doctrine of humanity, the essence of sin, the importance of Chalcedonian Christology, the necessity of an understanding and affirmation of an ontological trinity as well as an economic and social trinity, the nature of salvation and the identity of the gospel in its essence, the exclusivity of the gospel. All these were at stake. Also, of course, ecclesiology. First, there was a crisis of theology and doctrine, and it continues today. Secondly, a crisis of authority. This entire controversy came in the context of an anti-authoritarian age, as America and the larger culture had taken a turn against authority. Nonetheless, it is an inescapable issue for all organizations and bodies. I remember an observation made by a political science professor I had in college. If you'll notice, even anarchist groups have leaders. Authority is an inescapable issue, or as put by R.G. Bunker, the great philosopher, speaking to Meathead, how is it all you nonconformists look alike? But authority is modeled, understood, conceived in very different ways, and its operational dynamics vary from group to group and from vision to vision. All parties to the Southern Baptist conflict claimed an adherence to biblical authority. But the question is, what Bible, what is the Bible, and how is its authority operational? The crisis of authority reminds one of the model of the Wesleyan quadrilateral, often used to describe authority, especially in a Wesleyan tradition, scripture, experience, reason, and tradition. Any honest observer would have to say that both moderates and conservatives and all variations in between have some conception of authority related to scripture and experience, reason, and tradition. But the question is how these are held in symmetry and which is the greater authority that delimits and modifies and calls into accountability all other authorities. Third, there's a crisis of confessionalism, and if this was unclear in 1963, it was undeniable in the year 2000, lest I forget. with the adoption of the most recent revision of the Baptist Faith and Message. There were skips and beats all along. In 1969, the issue of the binding authority, the 1963 Baptist Faith and Message, arose in concerns about the Sunday School Board and the mission boards and hiring policies. At that time, the convention adopted a motion. It was a compromise measure instructing the institutions and agencies of the SBC to use the Baptist Faith and Message as a guideline in editorial and employment decisions. However, that was not only not uniformly accepted, like the McDaniel resolution, it had a very short-term effect, if any. By the time you get to 1998 and the adoption of the so-called Family Amendment to the Baptist Faith and Message, one sees explicit arguments on confessionalism in Southern Baptist life which probably had not been seen since the 1920s. There was some debate in the 1960s. It's interesting to look at the state papers. But the debate had changed from the 20s to the 60s. In the 20s, there was an open debate over whether Baptists should be a confessional people at all, which I would argue shows just how far Baptists had developed, at least up to the 1920s, from our confessional roots. By the 1960s, the argument was not so much whether we should have a confession or not, but whether it really mattered, and it seemed that to some minds, to treat a confession as so important that it ought to be revisited and revised was to give it more attention than was healthy and was due. But by the time you get to the Family Amendment in 1998, by the time you get to employment decisions being made on strictly confessional arguments in the 1990s, and then by the adoption of the Baptist Faith and Message in revised form in the year 2000, the confessional argument is explicit, it's public, and it's predictable. Generally, if you know where someone falls on other lines of Southern Baptist argument and debate, one is in no suspicion or mystery whatsoever as to where one will come down on the confessional issue. I would argue that the great threat here is and was theological minimalism. And as dangerous as anything is the desire of so many, sometimes on both sides of the controversy, to say, let's get it down to this. And that reductionism, I would argue, is the source of continuing theological crisis and identity. Among the moderates, this theological minimalism is most often by intention. Among the conservatives, it's largely by the temptation of pragmatism and by the sublimation of virtually all theological issues to operational concerns. First a crisis of theology, then of authority, then of confessionalism, and then of polity. The early stability of the 20th century emerged because a polity was hammered out in controversies of the 19th century, and especially over the threat to the denomination's stability represented by landmarkism. Those controversies were hot, and of course they were continuing, but the continuation of landmarkism in the 20th century was largely episodic, rural, and not too threatening to the denomination. By the time you get the adoption, not only of the Baptist Faith and Message, but of the cooperative program in 1925, the most independent aspects and anti-denominational aspects of landmarkism had obviously been overcome, at least in the larger part of the Southern Baptist Convention. There was an inherited stable polity. As evidence of that, just take Southern Seminary's history. It was established outside any formal act of the Southern Baptist Convention. And yet, in the early years of the 20th century, it was increasingly brought under the umbrella organizationally of the SBC until it emerged as an agency of the convention. Baptist associationalism and the principle of general Baptist bodies is an inherited model, and it largely formed the understanding. And I would argue that we can now see in retrospect that a major polity shift took place in 1925 with the formation of the cooperative program. And there was an unintentional shift in polity, the significance of which has even now not been fully understood in magnitude. However, recent actions of the Baptist General Convention of Texas have helped to serve as a catalyst for rethinking some of these issues all over again. And as then, also now, not without trauma. Certainly not without controversy. In the Southern Baptist Convention, post the controversy, there are serious issues of polity to be considered. Some of them are occasioned by division, that is, the creation of the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship. One of the clear polity questions that emerged at the convention in Orlando in 1994 was over whether or not the SBC should censure or excise churches that participated in the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship. And you may remember that that the decision was explicitly made by the convention in that year not to refuse to seat messengers. That's a double negative, I understand, but the vote was literally not to refuse to seat messengers that were participating in some sort of dimension with the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship. Now, there were two dimensions to that, I have to say, looking at it backwards in retrospect. The first was a matter of principle. The fact that attempting to understand Baptist associationalism, there really was no good precedent for such an action. But the second dimension of this was very practical. How in the world did you know who was and who was not a Cooperative Baptist Fellowship church, since their membership, insofar as they had membership, was so very opaque? And virtually anyone could be a member or not be a member, and it was very difficult to tell the difference. Now, a little footnote here, Associated Baptist Press has run a story today about the proposals to formalize membership in the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship adopted by their coordinating council, which is to become a governing board. And it's interesting at least to note that the issues might be different now if that question had not been answered then. But the SBC also faced other questions of polity. The Program and Structure Study Committee, of which I was a part, that brought its report in 1995, was a very serious effort to see if it could be possible to reduce the larger bureaucratic structures of the SBC and to revisit the whole question. I have to say, not just in retrospect, but at the time, there were many of us on the committee who felt that we had not revisited the whole question, that it was not possible to revisit the whole question in terms of the realities of the situation. But I think it's fair to say the report was much more dramatic and substantial than some had feared and or hoped, and not as far as some had feared. But the polity issues are still very confusing. How one relates to different Baptist bodies and to different Baptists is now a very complicated situation. State conventions face issues they have never faced before, and it's not just the cooperative program. It has to do with cooperative agreements between the mission boards. It has to do with where Baptist identity is most localized. This is an ongoing question. The Baptist General Convention of Texas has raised a whole constellation of issues, and the emergence of new state conventions is something that, again, could not have been conceived in a previous generation as an expectation, and now it is a reality. And the SBC has found a way to accommodate this in some way in its polity. The question is, the SBC or not? That's a new question. How do you now know who's a Southern Baptist and who isn't? Just taking the SBC charter and bylaws and its constituting documents. One's a Southern Baptist if one contributes to Southern Baptist causes and does so in a way that makes a congregation eligible to send messengers to the Southern Baptist Convention. But that means that individuals have never been members of the Southern Baptist Convention. Congregations are actually authorized to send messengers to the Southern Baptist Convention, and then by extension, one is a member of a local church if it is Southern Baptist in self-conscious identity and in legal cooperation, financial contribution, then one is, by extension, a Southern Baptist. But an individual can't resign from the Southern Baptist Convention, nor can an individual join it. But most Southern Baptists don't know that, and that is only one dimension of polity that is not well understood. Churches have very little understanding of polity. I'd say, first of all, their own, insofar as they have any clearly articulated polity. They have been disengaged from any polity stipulated largely in a confession, and instead, many of our churches are freelancing polity on their own in church government. You can see the emergence of many different models, and it's interesting, again, that this is taking place not only among conservatives, but also in moderate churches in Southern Baptist life. The whole issue of church government is up for grabs, and unfortunately, I think, with very little awareness of how Baptists have debated these issues biblically in the past. It is a cultural crisis. Fifth, different readings of the cultural context, different responses to the culture of late modernity and of post-modernity, moral issues, political engagement. The restraints are now off, and that's what's very interesting to see. Tragic in some eyes and to be celebrated in others, but just to take the issue of homosexuality, look at the different patterns of response between the SBC and some other Baptist bodies. and between Southern Baptist institutions and some other Baptist institutions. Perhaps in a way that is even more clear than the abortion issue was in the earliest public phase of the Southern Baptist controversy, this is now even acknowledged by the CBF as an issue of monumental concern. An interesting statement by Dan Vestal in today's release that he's trying to deal with the deeply held convictions of some of their own churches. But the restraints are now off in a way. The conservatives and the moderates are in a very different position. The conservatives now have leadership they never expected to have with all the responsibility that comes with that leadership. And many of the moderates are now freed from any kind of institutional constraint, and they're outside a Southern Baptist culture in which these issues were often denied or at least translated in such a way that the boundary-exceeding nature of the position was not well understood by the larger body of the Southern Baptist Convention. But those constraints or restraints are now off. And so what we see is an even greater division now on these cultural issues, moral issues, and theological issues than was even apparent at the time. But they're the same people, by and large. Lastly, as we have said, it is an identity crisis, and this is what is most basic. It comes down to the question of what is at the core of Baptist identity. It's a question of whether we stand in continuity with the larger evangelical tradition. So I would emphatically argue a debate over whether or not we are a confessional people. Not just that we adopt confessions, but that these confessions actually regulate our practice and shape our culture and represent our most deeply cherished beliefs. I would argue that there's a question as to whether Baptists are merely a sect within the larger context of American Protestantism, or whether we are a confessional body of believers with distinctive beliefs. The true parties, truth and liberty, still exist. And what's interesting is, to some degree, now within, for instance, the CBF and within the SBC, there are lingering parts of both of these parties still in an ongoing debate. But I want to argue the issue of identity comes down to a different dimension. And using models from Clifford Geertz and other anthropologists and cultural people in the cultural studies fields, I want to say that I believe that the identity crisis among Baptists now is between a tribal identity and a theological identity. First, the tribal identity. There are many Baptists who believe that the most fundamental identification of a Baptist is being a part of a group with a certain ethos, a certain attitude perhaps, tied largely to issues of autonomy and freedom, certain language, certain hymns. And it's interesting that there are persons who hold this as the paradigmatic, primary, and non-negotiable issue of Baptist identity. On the other side, you have those who say, no, the identity is most deeply theological. There is a tribal element to this, we all have to admit. You ask a conservative or a moderate when he or she became a Baptist, and most will begin with the story of cradle roll or some prenatal Baptist experience. Because there is a sense of this tribal identity that is true for all of us, at least who grew up in that kind of tribal culture. I mean, after all, anyone who can sing Jesus Wants Me for a Sunbeam has a tie to a Southern Baptist tradition that is not only memorable, but literally unforgettable. And we can never leave that behind. There is a tribal identity, and I realize that honesty compels me to say, I know that for myself, this is a part of me I can probably never fully understand from within. I've never been anything other than a Southern Baptist, and almost everyone in leadership in the SBC or in the CBF or other groups never was anything but a Southern Baptist at any time. And there's a sense in which we still know the handshake, even if we're not in the same polity or in the same convention and fellowship any longer. The tribal dimension is not to be denied. The issue of debate comes as to whether there is also an essential and non-negotiable theological aspect to identity. And the question comes down to whether the tribal issues are accountable to the theology or the theology to the tribal ethos. This is a very difficult issue for both conservatives and for moderates, and especially moderates related to the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship. I don't think it's a deep issue for those who are now with groups, for instance, like what used to be the Southern Baptist Alliance that is now the Alliance of Baptists. Just look at the seminary sponsored by the CBF and by the SBC. You're looking at two very different visions of theological education, two very different student bodies, two very different faculties. Look at what the faculties write. Look at the production. Look at what is taught. It's a very different understanding. I think the tribal identity is really a matter now that is largely generational. I think to be able to say I was once a sunbeam is a matter of generational pride, and I may be one of the younger persons to have had that experience, and I can tell you most of our students assume that that has something to do with pagan sun worship and nothing to do with preschool Southern Baptist devotion. So that tribalism, I'm going to argue, will go away. I think this is one of the problems for the moderates, is what in the world holds together a movement when that tribal identity really isn't shared anymore by successive generations. But it is an enormous challenge for conservatives who assume that the younger generation of students in our seminaries will just understand who we are and want to be a part of it, when frankly they didn't have the same experiences either. And I do not have a percentage here, but I can tell you a very large percentage of our students were not Southern Baptists in their earliest and most formative years. Many of them were not Christians, and they did not grow up in Christian homes. And so they come to the SBC, if not tabula rasa, then at least unformed. And they do not share the symbolism. They're not a part of this ethos, and the tribal element simply isn't there. The reason that it's such a challenge for conservatives is because that really is an agent of cohesion within the Southern Baptist Convention, and without that glue holding generations together, I fear that what we may face in the Southern Baptist Convention is not so much a generation that didn't know Joseph or even a generation that didn't know James Pettigrew Boyce, but a generation that doesn't even know who Herschel Hobbes was. And that's a very different reality. Issues to watch in the Southern Baptist Convention as I close. Will the Southern Baptist Convention move into another merely programmatic denominational culture? That seems to be the temptation, regardless of who is in power and bearing responsibility in the SBC. Secondly, will the SBC retain a younger generation in loyalty and in leadership? I think the so what question is very much a part of the generation to come. The SBC had better show itself very serious about Great Commission tasks and cultural engagement and other things of importance to this generation, because they're not going to drive Oldsmobiles. It's going to be impossible, I understand, in a few years. Nor are they going to follow a generalized Southern Baptist tradition just because it is so. Third, will the subtle and not so subtle pressures of modernity and postmodernity lead to a seductive transformation of the SBC? I think that's another big danger. You know, there's no danger at present of an accommodationist, liberalizing resolution being adopted on the floor of the Southern Baptist Convention. And such an issue is faced explicitly. I'm confident that the convention is going to respond in a way it understands to be deeply biblical and convictional. The problem comes with all those unarticulated issues and unexplicit issues before us. Fourth, will the SBC be able to retain the loyalty and support of local churches? That is just not a given. Again, in an older era of denominational cohesiveness and of a programmatic culture, one could not imagine anything otherwise, but one can certainly imagine it now. Fifth, will the SBC develop a mature mode of cultural engagement and political activity? This is a big question. I think most Southern Baptists in the early part of this century didn't know they were politically and culturally engaged. They didn't have to think about it. We cannot avoid such discussions and debate and hard thinking in the present. And some of you are doing good work in terms of analyzing this and putting forth an argument. But I will say that this is far more complicated than people think. I'll give you one anecdote. Institution called here this past week looking for an SBC conservative leader to debate in a public format to defend President Bush's faith-based initiative. When it was discovered that no senior administrator here would debate that issue and champion those proposals, there was genuine shock on the other side, because the assumption was that SBC conservatives would be quickly jumping to this, simply, I guess, because it comes from a Republican administration and is championed by so many evangelical Christians. But again, that shows the complexity of these issues. And yet, Southern Baptists have never worked out a well-developed, theologically grounded, biblically shaped, culturally sophisticated mode of engagement. Six, will missions continue to be the driving energy of the entire denominational system? And when you build your entire system on missions, and missions is what drives it, there are obviously deeply operational issues at stake, but there are inherently theological issues at stake. And this is a question. I can tell you that I believe the generation of students at our seminaries now do not represent a threat to the missions focus and the Great Commission focus of the SBC. The question is whether the SBC will meet their expectations of how serious a denomination should be about focusing on Great Commission tasks. If the denomination appears to be a middleman, an obstruction, a bureaucracy, then there will be, I think, a shift towards more direct congregational and personal involvement at the expense of denominational involvement. Seven, will demographic changes overwhelm Baptist polity and patterns of organization? I was a part of a research project a few years ago that attempted to take into account what the metropolitan shape of the SBC meant for us as a denomination, having been established largely on rural grounds. That research is now so dated, it would need to be updated considerably. But just taking data up to the mid-1980s, the demographic shifts in Southern Baptist life were so monumental, and yet because of the larger theological, political, and other issues in the controversy, no one's really paying attention to this. But there are some models that indicate that the vast majority attendance in Southern Baptist churches will be in 19 standard metropolitan statistical areas within the next decade. And that's something no one really has taken into account. We keep talking about the fact we're a denomination of rural churches. We are by number, but not by membership, and certainly not by attendance, and never by influence. And we keep talking about the fact that we have 45,000 churches, and the average size of the church is something a little less than 300, but that is not the average size of a church attended by the average Southern Baptist, and that's a different question entirely. And the large church phenomenon, the mega church phenomenon, the metropolitan phenomenon, all this gives a very different context to our polity and its application. I mean, how in the world do you have a Baptist congregational meeting with a membership of 15,000 persons and an attendance of multiple thousands? There's a real question of how our polity can respond to that and what these demographic changes will mean. I thank you for your attention tonight. And I hope these thoughts have been helpful in some way in framing a debate. And in the best sense of that, in an academic context, it is a debate we hope will come, and from which perhaps not heat but light will emerge. Thank you.